Today is Friday, September 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump holds a big campaign rally in Michigan Thursday night despite fallout from a new book's revelations on his early knowledge of the dangers of COVID-19.
Hello, Michigan, and I'm thrilled to be in Freeland with thousands of loyal, hardworking American patriots.
Catastrophic wildfires continue to rage up and down the west coast of the United States.
I took a picture and it was just a wall of smoke.
Also ahead, the boss, Bruce Springsteen, will soon give fans a reason to celebrate. It's all on today's International Edition. Amid a political crisis over his own taped words, President Donald Trump headed out for the support of a rally in the battleground state of Michigan Thursday, trying to move past revelations that he played down the danger of the coronavirus last winter, despite describing it in private as, quote, deadly stuff. AP White House correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Asked at a news conference why he lied to the American people, the president shook his head, saying what he did was minimize the threat to avoid causing panic.
There was no lie here.
And that his actions to stop the virus's spread show he took it seriously.
That doesn't mean I'm going to jump up and down in the air and start saying people are going to die, people are going to die. No. No.
Still, Democrats like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi say his public downplaying revealed a president unconcerned with saving American lives.
Showed his contempt. Contempt for the American people and their health.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The new book by veteran Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward is also shining more light on the unlikely relationship between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The book won't be released until next week, but the U.S.-based cable news network CNN and The Post have published excerpts. VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul has details.
For his new book entitled Rage, journalist Bob Woodward had access to 25 letters exchanged between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It is an unprecedented behind-the-scenes look at one of the most unexpected diplomatic relationships in world history. In the letters, Kim showers Trump with praise, repeatedly addressing him as Your Excellency and hailing their deep and special friendship. After their first meeting in Singapore in June 2018, Kim reportedly reminisced about holding Trump's hand. Kim called their second meeting in Hanoi a moment of glory that remains a precious memory. Trump returned the praise, calling Kim far beyond smart. According to the Washington Post, Trump boasted to Woodward that Kim tells me everything, including a graphic description of how he killed his uncle in 2013. The letters are grabbing headlines, but they may hurt the prospect of nuclear talks, said veteran Korea observer Mark Berry.
To have any excerpts of it published either in his book or as occurred today on CNN, you know, that's privileged diplomatic communications.
The matter is also tricky, Barry said, since Kim's words are typically treated with the utmost respect in authoritarian North Korea.
You don't misuse the great leader's words in a callous way. I mean, the worst that can happen is that internally, Kim could appear to be a supplicant to Trump.
North Korea has not responded to the release of the correspondence, but it may not be too surprised, since Trump previously tweeted out one of Kim's letters in July 2018. Trump and Kim didn't always get along. In 2017, the two regularly exchanged insults, with Trump calling Kim Little Rocket Man and Kim slamming Trump as a mentally deranged U.S. dotard. At one point, Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea. The tensions dissipated after Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to meet a North Korean leader. Trump later claimed the two fell in love. The relationship has held firm, even after North Korea last year resumed short-range ballistic missile tests and walked away from nuclear negotiations. If he wins re-election in November, Trump has said he will reach a deal very quickly with Kim. Trump's opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, has said he will not continue Trump's personal outreach to Kim, signaling a return to a more traditional U.S. posture. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Microsoft says state-backed hackers have stepped up targeting of U.S. political campaigns, including the Biden campaign. It says the same Russian military intelligence outfit that hacked the Democrats in 2016 has tried to break into more than 200 organizations, including political parties and consultants. Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny is speaking again and continues to make progress at a German hospital where he's recovering from what Germany says was poisoning by a Soviet-era nerve agent. Berlin is demanding answers from Russia, which denies any involvement. Meanwhile, top U.S. lawmakers are calling on the Trump administration to launch an investigation into Navalny's poisoning. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports on the increasing calls for punitive sanctions on Russian President Vladimir Putin and his government.
Just before he was poisoned last month, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was said to be working on one of his many investigative reports about Russian government corruption in the Siberian city of Tomsk. He was stricken during a return flight to Moscow and later transferred to Germany. The 44-year-old is now out of a coma at Berlin's Charité Hospital, but the hospital says it is too early to gauge the potential long-term effects of the poisoning. The Kremlin has denied any involvement in the incident and dismissed any accusations of a crime. President Donald Trump had this response when asked last week about Navalny's poisoning.
We haven't had any proof yet, but I will take a look. It is interesting that everybody's always mentioning Russia, and I don't mind you mentioning Russia, but I think probably China at this point is a nation that you should be talking about much more so than Russia, because the things that China is doing are far worse.
Despite Trump's remarks, the group of seven foreign ministers, including U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, released a statement Tuesday condemning Russia for the poisoning. Their statement cited toxicological evidence by German medical specialists that Navalny was the victim of a chemical nerve agent. They went on to call on Russia to bring those responsible to justice. On Capitol Hill, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, a Democrat, and the ranking Republican member, Michael McCaul, sent a letter to President Trump requesting he order an investigation. Representative Bill Keating told VOA there is bipartisan support for action on Navalny.
What I hope for and what I think will occur, there will be discussion that's bipartisan in nature, not just Democrats or not just Republicans, but together.
Representative Tom Malinowski is calling for punitive sanctions against Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Sanctions alone are not going to turn Vladimir Putin into a pussycat, but the absence of punitive sanctions also would send a message that the rest of the world either tolerates this kind of behavior or feels powerless to stop it.
The Kremlin has accused Germany of bluffing when it says it has unequivocal proof Navalny was poisoned. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
AstraZeneca's chief executive Thursday said it should know before the end of the year whether its experimental vaccine will protect people from COVID-19. If the British drug maker is allowed to resume trials, which were paused this week, it suspended the late-stage trials after an illness in a study subject in Britain. The patient was reportedly suffering from neurological symptoms associated with a rare spinal inflammatory disorder. The African continent is seeing both success and setbacks in its fight against coronavirus, with officials welcoming the opening of a network of genome sequencing laboratories, but also with news that the continent's only vaccine trial has been paused after one participant in the Oxford-based trial became ill. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
First, the good news from Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa. On Thursday, she announced that the WHO and the African Centers for Disease Control are opening 12 laboratories on the continent to work on COVID-19 genome sequencing and data analysis. She explained.
This network will help us to track the evolution of the virus, to better develop vaccines and treatments tailored to African populations, and it will also help us to stay a step ahead of COVID-19.
And now, with that forward step, here's the step back. The continent's first vaccine trial, being held in South Africa, has been paused. British-Swedish pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca announced this week it had to halt large-scale global trials of its COVID-19 vaccine because a volunteer participant in Britain became ill after receiving the experimental drug. In South Africa, the University of the Witwatersrand is testing the same vaccine on about 2,000 volunteers. The director of the South Africa trial, Professor Shabir Madi, announced the decision late Wednesday.
Pausing vaccination to review safety is evidence of the application of sound clinical practice and demonstrates the rigor of the independent oversight process under which the trials has been conducted. Assessing the safety of the vaccine is the reason why studies such as these are essential in South Africa before there is widespread use of the vaccine.
Moiti added that the study's decision to pause actually demonstrates the scientific strategy against the virus is working as it should.
One of the purposes of a clinical trial is to identify exactly this possibility that there may be adverse effects, as they are called, in the use of a tool. And in this case, very correctly, when it was found that a volunteer who had been healthy developed an illness, the study has been halted for the moment and all paused. And I think what this should be regarded as something that you might expect in the course of a clinical trial. So it should not cause us to panic.
Moiti added that globally there are 8 other candidate vaccines in phase 3 of trials. The sub-Saharan Africa region so far has reported just over 1 million confirmed COVID-19 cases, lower than in many parts of the world. The United States currently carries the world's heaviest burden of the virus, with more than 6.2 million cases, according to WHO data. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
After 4 years of tumultuous Brexit talks, Britain and the European Union held emergency talks Thursday over Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to act outside international law by breaching parts of the Brexit divorce treaty, a step Brussels has warned will prevent any chance of a trade deal. Joining us now for more is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, explain exactly what is this all about?
Back in January, the UK government signed an agreement with the EU that laid out the grounds for their future trade relations with the European Union when the UK formally leaves the EU at the end of this year. And this treaty, this agreement they signed that's based in international law, was really, if you like, the goodwill part of all this. It laid everything out. It showed that both sides were working towards having a respectable arrangement when it came to trade. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, just as the two sides were going to an 8th round of talks, the Europeans got wind that UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson was going to have his government publish a bill which rewrote part of that agreement, essentially walking away from an international agreement. This came as a complete shock. Not just because this is an international agreement and that's not what you do, but it just completely undermined all trust that has been built up over the last few months in these talks. Not only the trust, but also it's illegal. It is an international agreement. It's been ratified. So this essentially has just, if you like, caused this most enormous breakdown of negotiations over a new trade deal between those two countries. When we talk about that trade deal, these are not small trade deals. If you look, the UK exports 43% of its total exports to the European Union. So it needs a deal, because if it doesn't have a deal by the end of this year, then it will have tariffs on those exports. And there will be tariffs on imports coming from the European Union. So they do need to have a deal, or else it will be very expensive for the UK to export, we also expect them to import, and their biggest trading partner will essentially be almost, you know, their biggest foe.
They were scolded by the EU, saying they've broken their trust and really urging them to back down from this. Has the UK given any indication that it is going to scrap this idea?
It was pretty clear coming from the meeting that was held, an urgent meeting that was held in London, between the European Union official and the British official in charge of this, that no, the UK is not going to back down. In fact, it will be tabled in Parliament next Monday. The UK government says that it is just a bill that is a way of ensuring that the United Kingdom is able to trade, is able to be a unit after they leave the EU. The EU side, they were pretty, I really had never seen such strong language. They asked the UK to withdraw this bill. They said if it's not withdrawn by the end of the month, then they will take the United Kingdom to court. They will take them to the European Court of Justice. These are the sort of language that you really don't expect from one's very close partners. The other point in all this, of course, is it's not just on trade. The United Kingdom relies a lot on the EU 27 nations for security cooperation. I mean, let's just look in the last few weeks. We've seen the UK being part of the EU's response to Russia over the alleged poisoning of Alexei Navalny. He's still in a Berlin hospital. Plus, there's all these other agreements on what they do with illegal migrants, what they do with academic exchanges, all these other agreements also would just be on the dust.
Catherine, even here in the U.S., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said there wouldn't be any sorts of trade deals with the U.K. if they were violating international treaties. But how is the public there reacting?
Interestingly enough, as this final December 31st date of leaving the European Union approaches, the number of people who want to stay as part of the European Union has been increasing. Let's not forget that referendum they had, there was a sort of quite a clear majority in favour of leaving. Now that's changed. And as it comes closer, people are seeing some of the benefits that they're going to lose. But in Parliament, Boris Johnson has got a very firm majority in Parliament. He's got more than 80-seat majority. So this will, of course, go through the lower house of Parliament. Of course, a lot of people are looking at what the upper house of Parliament does, whether it will go through that. And that is where a lot of people who would just want to return to the status quo when EU, the UK were open trading partners with common values, they're wondering whether or not it will be this upper house of Parliament that might save the day. Difficult to say at the moment because right now the chances of either side giving way are very slim.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Colombia's defense ministry said Thursday that 7 people were killed during protests in the capital, Bogota, Wednesday night. The demonstrations were in response to the death of a lawyer in police custody. My colleague Jason Fatinkin spoke to journalist Megan Janetsky in Colombia's second city of Medellin.
This man's name is Javier Ordóñez. He's a Colombian father of 2. He's a lawyer in the country's capital of Bogota. And he was out drinking in the street and violating social distancing rules. And there's this video of police essentially with their knees on his back, shocking him with tasers as he's begging for them to stop, saying, please, no more. And after this ordeal, he ended up dying in the hospital, and it created, you know, a lot of anger in the Colombian public.
Yeah, and can you talk about that? What happened during the protests?
So last night, hundreds of protesters in Bogota mainly, but in other parts of the country too, they came out and were clashing with police. They gathered outside the police station where the man was held. And they were essentially throwing trash cans, rocks, and stick, battering windows. One police car was burned. 2 police stations were torched, and 3 others were heavily damaged. And the Ministry of Defense just confirmed that 7 people were killed, and almost 150 people were wounded in these clashes.
And what was the police response to the protests like?
Based on the photos we saw this morning, there was a lot of tear gas. It was definitely a forceful response. To give you an idea of the kind of force that was used by the Colombian state, there were 1,600 either federal agents or police officers congregated in Bogota, and more than half of them came from other parts of the country. So there was a really, really strong response by authorities.
Last of all, there's a lot of violence in Colombia with the different armed groups there, but are police killings in Colombia also common?
No, usually police killings aren't massive. Here, I think the most memorable one we've seen is at the end of last year, there were mass protests against the government, and riot police killed an 18-year-old boy named Dylan Cruz. And that was a really, really big thing because he was kind of turned into the symbol of this protest movement that was taking hold of Colombia at the end of last year. But generally, no, I think there's something to be said about these protests kind of tethering to this wave of protests in the United States. But also, I think it's something more than that. I think it's kind of a breaking point for this buildup of anger and frustration against the Colombian state that we've already seen, especially during COVID.
Journalist Megan Janetsky in Medellin, Colombia, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. A new 10-episode podcast documentary takes listeners inside some of the most impactful speeches in American history. Here's part two of my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham on his newly launched series, It Was Said, revisits the voices of figures whose words and messages were delivered at significant moments in the country but have remarkable relevance right now.
These voices tend to all speak to the battle between our darker instincts and what Lincoln called our better angels, right? That's the struggle that has defined the country. And these are people who, at given moments in time, some quite consciously, some by sheer happenstance, have stepped forward and spoken words that meet the great Greek definition of rhetoric. We tend to think of rhetoric now as empty phrases, right? Rhetoric in Greek explicitly meant words that would lead to action.
Interesting, too, one of the episodes, upcoming episodes, that you chose, also completely relevant to where we are right now, was Meghan McCain's eulogy to her father, the late Senator John McCain, on September 1st, 2018. You know, I hadn't thought about it in a while until I saw that it was one of your episodes, and immediately you go back to that raw grief, that pain, that really powered her ability to just feel unrestrained in what she said, including directed at the current president. It was striking, but also pretty unprecedented for a eulogy, don't you think?
Historians never use the word unprecedented, but it was unusual and notable, and it was a sign of the tumult of the political moment. There's an incumbent president of the United States who decided to repeatedly attack and belittle a man who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 5.5 years and who became a fabled United States senator and the nominee of the man's own party to be president. And when you read what Meghan McCain said, it's a powerful indictment of a kind of that emphasizes the attack over the aspirational. It emphasizes the knockout punch versus the national interest. And so I think it was all the more powerful because these were words that the speaker clearly, firmly believed deeply about the secular world being spoken in a sacred place. And many of our most important public moments have occurred when the sacred and the secular have intersected. That was the lectern where George W. Bush addressed the nation after September 11th. That's the lectern from which presidents are eulogized across the transept. It's the Canterbury pulpit where Dr. King preached that final Sunday sermon. So that's a remarkable place. And it was a eulogy not only for her father, but for a way of looking at and being in America. And there are a lot of us who hope that can be restored, but that's still on the ballot.
Many Americans are feeling a sense of fear, despair. The world feels upside down right now. I don't think many Americans ever in their lives, certainly in my case, never contemplated the possibility that one day we could potentially cease to be a democracy. Have we all just taken it for granted? And what do speeches like this in these episodes, why is it so important for us to revisit them and think about how they relate now?
There's an old trope from the 18th century, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Of course, this is a tenuous and complicated experiment. It depends on all of us. It depends on the dispositions of heart and mind that are willing to recognize the claims of a common interest over solely personal interest. That's the American covenant. And I pay taxes to help you, even though I may not see any benefit, on the promise that if I need help, you'll be there too. But that is, in fact, a promise. It may not be a reality. And there are people who are not as advantaged as I have been in life, for instance, who are part of that covenant, who work hard, whose wages adjusted for inflation haven't really gone up in 32 years, who fight for health care, who fight to educate their kids, who now fight to fend off a virus, who trust that enough of those who didn't have to fight for those things will be there for them. And because that is a human undertaking, because it's based on human aspiration, being able to trump human ambition, it's a touch and go thing. As Wellington said of Waterloo, it's the damnedest close run thing you ever saw in your life. And so I don't think we should take anything for granted. These anti-democratic lowercase d forces ebb and they flow. They flowed in the 50s with Joe McCarthy. They flowed in the 50s and 60s with the white backlash to civil rights. And they're flowing now. But at our best, we have managed to make them ebb a little bit more than we are at the moment.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham on his new podcast documentary, It Was Said, launched this week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Radio.com. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Planet Earth has a lot going on. Flooding in Senegal and Sudan as farmers worry about the future. Fires. VOA's Arash Arbasadi brings us a special week in space.
With eyes on our home, planet Earth.
This is the port of Beirut, 1 month after a blast that was so powerful it was visible from space. The August explosion of ammonium nitrate stored in a port warehouse killed almost 200 people, injured thousands of others, and destroyed homes and buildings in a vast area of the Lebanese capital. The latest fire is in a tire warehouse, according to state media. The cause remains unknown. Meanwhile, in Sudan, authorities and the United Nations are providing aid to tens of thousands who lost their homes in recent record Nile flooding. Local resident Idris Ahmed wants international help.
What is the role of government? Nothing. They're not doing anything. I'm asking for rights as a citizen, looking for refuge. I go right, I go left. Is this something anyone can accept?
Across the continent, in Senegal, the town of Kerem Assar remains underwater after clouds dumped 3 months' worth of rain in just 7 hours over this area outside the capital city, Dakar. The flooding is creating even worse hardship for residents.
We are flooded. We're all going through the same problem. It's serious. Some people left. Some people are unable to reach their homes. Firefighters are helping evacuate with boats. It's really difficult.
Finally, this week, residents in California report awakening to orange skies raining ash as wildfires exploded out of control. In one day alone, climate scientists say one fire expanded more than 1,000 square meters. More than 14,000 firefighters are battling the California blazes. Two of the largest in the state's history are burning in the San Francisco Bay Area, though after 3 weeks, those are mainly under control. However, wildfire season has just begun. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Bruce Springsteen will release a new album he recorded live in his New Jersey home studio with the E Street Band. The Boss said Thursday the album is called Letter to You, and he and the band recorded it in just 5 days.
It will be released on October 23rd. Letter to You will have 9 new songs and include new recordings of 3 songs that predate Springsteen's 1973 debut album, Greetings from Ashbury Park, New Jersey. Springsteen's last album was the orchestral pop Western Stars. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.